All right, so this morning we're going to continue the series that we started, it seems like forever ago now, and I have to apologize a certain amount. I did not, when I started this series, plan on being gone for 2 out of 3 weeks, and I appreciate those that reminded me that I'm 1 out of 3 in the last 3 weeks, so I appreciate that. No, I apologize. I didn't plan on being gone so much, but things coming up and being with family and stuff, I appreciate the opportunity to be away, but I do miss all of you when I'm gone as well, and I appreciate that, you know. You miss me, those of you that miss me anyway, I guess, so, and just glad to be back. But we are going to continue the I Am series that we started several weeks ago now, and we've got only just a couple weeks to go, but I hope that even as we kind of finalize, even if you feel a little disjointed, because I know I feel a little disjointed kind of jumping back and forth here and there, but hopefully the last couple weeks as we wrap up are going to be worthwhile as well. Before we jump into this morning's story, we kind of already got a good preview, and most of you have heard this story before, I know, but just to remind us as we have gone through this series, the purpose of why we're talking about these I Am statements. There are 7 I Am statements in the book of John that Jesus makes, these metaphorical statements of I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the door, I am the good shepherd, all of these different things that Jesus is saying. Why is he doing this? What is the purpose for all of his words and what he's trying to say? And really, why I wanted to do it leading up to Christmas, like I said, we were supposed to wrap this up kind of really last week as we kind of concluded the Christmas season. But the purpose of doing it at Christmas was to reveal that this is why Jesus came. You know, this is why he was a baby in the manger. This is why he entered into our world, why God himself decided to come into our world was these I Am statements. And they kind of cover different nuances and different aspects of why Jesus came. And I think they're different and they're nuanced slightly. They're kind of all the same, but because I think they connect with us differently. I don't know if any of them have connected with you uniquely. Actually, next week's I Am statement is what I connect with the most. And not because of the imagery or because of, you know, things that I understand as much as, to me, it just reveals the heart and soul of where we should go moving forward. And so, hopefully, I'm looking forward to doing that one as well. But really, the point of all of this, as I've said over and over and over again, is about knowing Jesus. It's about knowing Jesus. And these I Am statements reveal who Jesus is, why he came, what he's all about, his purpose. And we can study these I Am statements, right? It's so easy to study these statements and still just know more about Jesus, right? We can know more about him in this as well. But that wasn't the point of why he said these. He said this because he wants us to know him. As much as he knows us, he wants us to know him in these unique ways as well. And so that's been my hope working through this, that we can truly know him and understand him better. And really this morning's message, this resurrection and the life that we're going to look at, is really the crux of it all. I've been listening to primarily one pastor that's walked through these I Am statements as well, just to kind of get some background and information from him as well in my study. And he actually switched things around so that this was the climax of the whole series. Because in so many ways, it is. It is the point, it is the essence of why Jesus is, who he is, and the things that he's decided to do and come to know. And when we know him, we understand this statement as well. And so with all that being said, if you have your Bibles or a Bible app, we're going to be looking at John chapter 11. We already heard the story. Again, you probably know the story pretty well. So what I want to do is fairly quickly is just highlight certain verses, highlight certain aspects of this story, and just pull out some of the cultural things that I think are fascinating, but really probably more the relational and the emotional kind of things that I see in this story that I think are worthwhile and worth looking at. And so if you've got a Bible or Bible app, John chapter 11 is where we'll be at. We're going to look more closely at verses 17 through 38, but to kind of set our context in the first 16 verses, basically what happens is Lazarus gets suddenly sick. And it's a quick, progressing, sudden sickness. It's not a cancer that kind of slowly leads to his death. It's not something they've known about. It's something that's sudden and unexpected from what we kind of gather from the story. And so Martha and Mary, Lazarus' sisters, Mary and Martha, send for Jesus to come for probably 2 reasons. One is because they're close. There's a relationship there between the two, between Martha, Mary, Lazarus, and Jesus. But also because they know what Jesus can do and who he is and what he can provide. And so they're calling, requesting him to come. And we can see in the story that he waits 2 more days. He hears that Lazarus is sick and to go and visit. And he waits 2 more days purposely before he goes. But when he's ready to go, him and his disciples have kind of an interesting interaction. And I encourage you, if you have time this week, shouldn't say it that way, I encourage you to make time this week to read John chapter 11, read the whole story, just to get an understanding of what's going on and see some of this dialogue. But one thing we see in the first 16 verses is this dialogue between Jesus and his disciples. And in that dialogue, we see several different things. One, the disciples still don't seem to get it. And I guess that's probably the primary thing we see from this, is Jesus will say something like, he says Lazarus has fallen asleep. And the disciples are like, well, if he's sleeping, then he's going to get better, and that's great. We want him to sleep. And then Jesus says, no, you guys, he's dead, right? And so he's got to be plain and clear with them because they just don't get it. But ultimately, they may not even just get the purpose and what Jesus, because Jesus has over and over again in the last several chapters here said, this is where I'm headed. This is where I'm going. This is going to lead to death. This is going to lead to an end to my life ultimately. And things are going to change moving forward. And the disciples either aren't ready to hear that, don't want to hear that, or just kind of miss the whole thing. But it seems like there might be something deeper as well. Because just before they leave to go see Lazarus and his sisters, Jesus says this in verse 14, and I don't have it on the screen, but verse 14, Jesus tells his disciples, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I am glad that I was not there so that you may believe. So that you may believe. And wherever the disciples are at, or whatever they're thinking or experiencing, there's something lacking in their faith. There's something lacking in their belief of who Jesus is, or what he's going to do, or ultimately his purpose. And so I think there's probably some of us this morning, myself to a certain extent as well, that our belief isn't quite where Jesus wants it to be. And not saying that's bad or wrong to doubt or any of those kind of things necessarily, but there's a step in our faith, a step in our belief and our trust of Jesus that needs to be taken. And that's where the disciples are, and I think there's probably some this morning that are kind of at that point as well. And so with that in mind, Jesus and his disciples are going to head over in verse 17 of John chapter 11 to see Lazarus and his sisters. He says this in verse 17. Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. And verse 20 says this, so when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. But Mary remained seated in the house. If you heard my children's story this morning, or you understood what I was trying to say, you heard the story of Mary and Martha and Jesus when Jesus comes to visit and was teaching and different things like that, where Mary chooses to sit and listen to Jesus, and Martha's running around doing all this chores and activities and preparations for guests or whatever is going on. And then obviously the focus was Mary chose to listen to Jesus, and that was better than doing the things, because Martha's doing the things that are expected of her. In that culture, the expectation is there are people coming or there's guests in the house. The women would go and prepare the meal, would prepare the house for all of these things to happen. And that was the expectation. So Martha, she's dotting every I, she's crossing every T, she's doing her due diligence to do what is right in her eyes. She's kind of what I would say is maybe kind of a goody-goody or just following the rules. And it's interesting that when Jesus shows up for here with Lazarus' death, that something changes with Martha, really kind of changes with Mary and Martha. Mary chooses to listen to Jesus, which seems like the right thing and the best thing, even though it goes against the cultural expectations and maybe the rules at the time. Whereas Martha breaks the rules here, because at that time, there were 7 days, and I love Jewish mourning practices. I don't know if I've said that before, but their mourning practice, not mourning like getting up in the morning and getting dressed, those things, but how they grieve, maybe I'll say it that way. Because for 7 days after someone in their family, someone close passed away, the expectation was is that the family would sit on the floor in their home and just mourn. Whether that's crying or whether that's weeping, I don't know if they told stories of their family or different things like that, but the expectation is for 1 week they would sit in their house and the community around them, you know, extended family or if you read in the text here, it talks about the Jews from Jerusalem coming to help, they would take care of their needs, food and shelter, if kids needed to be taken care of, whatever it was. And their expectation was they would sit in their house and just mourn for 7 days. Well, within that first 7 days, Jesus shows up, and Martha pushes aside all of the cultural expectations of sitting and mourning in her home and rushes out to talk to Jesus. And I think that's important because we experience Martha maybe in a different way that her emotions, that her experience, that her sorrow and her grief in that situation has come to a point where she's going to go and do something beyond her normal attitude, maybe even beyond her character. And so she rushes out to Jesus, and in verse 21, she says this to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And I guess in my experience of reading that, I see a lot of pain, right? Most of us have lost someone close to us, maybe even a sudden loss like Lazarus. And so maybe we kind of understand a little bit of where Martha's at. There's a pain, right? There's a grief. I'm going to do whatever I can to kind of make myself feel a little bit of relief. And so she rushes out and she kind of blames Jesus. Why weren't you here? But then right after that, she says this, "But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." So it seems like she says, well, why weren't you here? But I know that God will provide you whatever you ask him. And so there seems to be kind of a tension in Martha. All this pain and emotion, but then I also know there's some things, and maybe it's a little bit of religious platitude, right? Because we've all said those kind of things where, right, someone passes away and we say they're in a better place or whatever else. And those aren't bad. I'm not saying we shouldn't say those things. I say those and we'll continue to say those things. But there's kind of a tension here. I know something and there's a truth that I have in my mind, but I'm feeling all of these things. And there's something maybe going on here that within Martha where she wants to believe that in all these things that Jesus has done, because she's seen him drive out demons and heal people and feed thousands of people. But she also knows that she also doesn't know for sure what's going to happen. Is Jesus going to do something? Can he do something? Does he have that power and authority? And then also she says this in verse 24 to kind of add to this whole thing. She says, "I know that Lazarus, that he will rise again at the resurrection in the last day." And again, another kind of religious platitude, something they believed in that culture, just like we as Christians believe there's going to be a resurrection, right? And they believe that, and she's going to say that. Again, there's more of these things in her head that she can tell, that she can say, that she wants to believe, but she doesn't know if she can truly and ultimately believe them. And so what I see in Martha is this tension between some of the things that she sees in the future. Yeah, I know he's going to come back. I know there's a resurrection. I know there's a hope in the future. The problem is it could be a distant future, thousands of years, millions of years maybe even. But then she's also looking at Jesus and saying, well, why weren't you here? Why didn't you save my brother? Why isn't he still with us? And I just think it's such a cool dynamic, or such an interesting dynamic, I guess, in terms of where Martha is at. Because I think a lot of us fall into that place. I know I do that very often. Is where I'll look at the past and I'll see the things that I wish would have gone differently, or I would have done differently, or I wish this person had done this differently. And I look at the past and I think, well, I wish things would have happened differently, or maybe even nostalgia, where I say, well, that was really cool and I like that and I want to reminisce on that. And then maybe we get caught up in the future, saying, well, I'm excited about this, or this is going to happen, or maybe this will happen in the future, or I'm looking forward to this. The problem is that when we look to the back, and we look to the look to the past, and we look to the future, our current tends to look really flat. The weight of the past and the weight of the future kind of flatten the now. As a parent, if I had a nickel for every time someone said, just enjoy your kids for where they're at now, I'm pretty sure I'd be a millionaire at this point in time. But I agree. I say that too. And it is true, right? We need to enjoy where we're at right now. The problem is when they are an infant and they are crying for absolutely no reason other than just to cry, it's hard to enjoy them in that moment, right? Or if they're not sleeping through the night, you know, there are times, I've heard that and I say, it's so hard. I want to enjoy this baby because I know, and especially as I, you know, if I've had two or three or four and five, that I realize they do grow up really fast. And that once they hit, you know, I want to enjoy them as a baby because they can't get away from you when they're a baby, right? And they're going to sit there and they have to let you hold them. When they get to even 2 and 10 and 4 and 12, they don't let you hold them anymore, which is, you know, I guess I can hold them and wrangle them down if I really wanted to. But, you know, and it's so hard, though, to just enjoy them for where they're at because you're looking forward to something. But then you get to a point and you think, well, I really wish my 10-year-old was still a 2-year-old, right, or a 1-year-old, and I wish he or she was, and we just get caught up in well, what's going to happen in the future? I wish they'd sleep through the night, because sleeping through the night was a huge step for all of our kids. And now that they're all sleeping through the night is wonderful. But we get caught in that tension so that our world and the current that we're in just becomes so flat and just gets smashed down. I don't know if you ever feel that way, where your world and your attitude and the things around you just feel so flat and lifeless, and there's just very little, and it's not vibrant at all. And I think a lot of that is where Martha's at as well. We're looking so much to the future, or we're looking so much to the past, even good or bad in either, that our world and our current now is just flat. But what Jesus says to Martha is this: I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. I am. And I think this is true for all of his I am statements, but he's saying I am, not I was, not I will be, but I am. Right now, right in front of you. He doesn't discard Martha's emotions. He doesn't put aside her pain or even her frustrations at him, but he tells her that right now, this is where we are. And I am here, I am right in front of you, and right now is the only thing we can control, the only thing that we can do anything about. We can't change the past. The future's not here yet. What are we doing right now? I am. And I got to thinking that on accident, this ended up being a really good New Year's Eve or New Year's Day message, or New Year's message of the year. Because 2018 is gone, right? It's in the books. If you had a great 2018, you might be a little sad. If you had a real rough one, you might be like, yeah, I'm ready for something different. 2020 is not here yet. If you're looking forward to the election, and all that fun stuff, if you're looking forward to Olympics next year, I think it's summer next year. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's not here yet. Anything else maybe looking forward to in 2020? I don't know. We are in 2019. That is what is right in front of us. That is where we are. That is the world. That is the I am right now. And so what are we going to do? Are we going to look back at 2018 and say, well, that was great and I enjoyed that and this was awful and I wish that would have gone differently? Are we going to look at 2020 and say, yeah, I'm excited about this happening and looking forward to a change here or something different here? Or I'm really afraid and worried about this. Or are we going to say, this is 2019 and I am right here and Jesus himself is right here as well? Well, what did Jesus do then? Might be wondering, what am I going to do in 2019? Well, what did Jesus do in this story? We saw in the video kind of the story as an overall whole. I just love the chalupa bit. I don't know how appropriate that was, but I just love that part. What we didn't see in the video, though, was Jesus' emotions. And if you went to Bible camp or you grew up in the church when you were younger or something and you had to memorize scripture, one of your favorite verses to memorize was in here as well. But there are also two other emotional responses that Jesus had in this verse. Within six verses, there are three different emotional responses. Verse 33, it says this: when Jesus saw, this is Mary, when Jesus saw Mary weeping, and the Jews who were with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Then verse 35, one of our favorite verses, is Jesus wept. I just love that verse. Simple, profound in so many ways. But then in verse 38, again, we see Jesus, it says this: then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. Jesus is moved, deeply moved, to the point where he's weeping. And we could speculate maybe why he's weeping. And I think there's a few different reasons. One could be because of the sadness of Lazarus passing away, of a friend, of someone he loved dying. It could be the sadness, I think, to a certain extent, that these people are so broken and they're hurting and they don't have any anticipation that Jesus can do or will do anything. And I think he might be a little disappointed in them. Just like he seemed to be disappointed in the disciples. Well, I'm here. Why are you so upset? Why are you sad? Why are you hurting? I'm right here. Don't you expect anything from me? But what I think is most profound for me in seeing an image of Jesus in this context, in this story, is the idea of why Jesus really weeps, from my perspective, is because of the people around him. Not in disappointment, not in hurt, but in sadness because others around him are sad and hurt and grieving and broken. And I think Jesus weeps because Mary's weeping, because Martha's weeping, because all of these people around him are weeping and sad. And so Jesus, in his empathy and his understanding, is weeping as well. And to me, that is a wonderful image of Jesus. That when you were hurting, when we're broken, when things aren't going well and we're just lost, Jesus is weeping with us. But Jesus had a plan. Jesus had a purpose and a point to all of this. And it's been 4 days, right? And Jesus calls over to Scipioth to roll away that stone, right? And he stinketh. If you look up at the King James Version, that word stinketh, that's in there. It's in your Bibles, the word stinketh. I love that. One of my favorite things about the story, but that the King James still has it in there. Anyway, so Jesus has a plan. 4 days later, he's going to do something. And the 4 days is significant, partially because of I can't think of the right word, the speculation, because of the superstition, that's the word, the superstition that they had that after 3 days, then the spirit of that person would leave. For 3 days, that spirit kind of lingered over that person. Day four, that spirit was gone. So there's that superstition that Jesus is going against, but there's also a biological thing, and I don't think they understood biology the way we do, but after three and a half days, the internal organs are starting to break, are pretty well broken down, from my understanding. I don't know anything about that other than what people tell me. So, but the biological and the spiritual elements that Jesus says on 4 days, something needs to be different or something becomes different. And so Jesus tells this to the people in verse 40. He says, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" And he prays, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me." And then Jesus calls out, "Lazarus, come out." Lazarus comes out wrapped in his burial garments and the linen strips and comes out of the tomb. And though there are several things I think we can pull from this story, one primary thing Jesus is saying is he's pointing to the future. He's pointing to a time when he will go through this, when he will be buried, when he will die, but then he will be raised again as well. There is a foreshadowing here saying that I have the power, I have the authority, I have the ability, I am able to not only heal people and drive out demons and feed thousands of people, but I have a power and authority over death. And for those of us that grew up in the church, for myself, for a lot of us, and have heard these stories over and over again, to say that he has power over death just sounds like, well, yeah, of course. But that's significant. If Jesus, if he has the power over death, what else does he have power and authority over? What else can he control and manipulate and put into a path that makes things better? And we want to believe that in our heads. I want to believe that in my head, right? Yeah, Jesus has the power and authority. He can conquer death. He can conquer, and he can raise anything to life. But then I make choices. And I have an attitude that says, there's no hope. Well, he's never going to change. Her attitude, that's not going to change. I can't change. I'm always going to be this way. Well, that relationship, it's dead. Where we're going, well, we'll never be that. We'll never be that as a church, as a community, I'll never be that as a leader. All of these things, I don't know, it's dead. Lazarus was dead. And Jesus says, no, there's hope. I can bring anything, anything at all back to life. And he calls us and asks us to say, do you believe that? Do you trust that I can bring that person, that attitude, that relationship, that situation, that job, that I can restore it to something wonderful? Because if we don't believe that, if the resurrection never happened, if we don't trust that Jesus can provide that, then we're kind of wasting our time. Paul says that if there is no resurrection, then all of this is worthless. If there is no life after death, then what we're doing, what I'm doing, why we're here, any of this stuff, it doesn't matter. It's kind of a joke. But Jesus says, no, Lazarus, I raised Lazarus from the dead, and I was raised from the dead as well. The question is, do we believe it? There's an old story that talks about a Brahmin priest, a Hinduistic priest. And he was once asked, can you say, I am the resurrection and the life? And the priest says, well, sure, yes, I could say that I am the resurrection and the life. But could you get anyone to believe you? Jesus, it's easy to say I'm the resurrection and the life. The question is, do we believe it? And just like Martha, it's so easy to get caught up in the pain and the stress and the hurt in this world and looking at the past and looking at the future, instead of focusing on now, on I am the resurrection and the life, that we get so caught up in all of those things, especially the emotional turmoil that comes with it. To be able to say, no, we're going to move forward. How are we going to move forward? Jesus says, right now, 2019, this morning, what steps are we going to take? Because Jesus, just like he calls out Lazarus, he calls out all of us. And the last few words that Jesus gives us in this story, he says, unbind him and let him go. Jesus, being the resurrection and the life, wants to unbind anything that's holding us back and to let us go free. The question is, what are we going to do?